For some, the sea is not a place. It is a calling, a home away from home. If you find yourself drawn to the water, we can take you there. Imagine you, your friends, and family on a private yacht in the most beautiful places in the world, from the Bahamas or the Virgin Islands to Greece, Italy, Tahiti, and beyond. This is a yacht charter vacation with The Moorings, and it's easier than you think. Inquire today. Your next great vacation begins at moorings.com.
While the world whizzes by, enjoy a moment of me time with Tim Horton's $6 breakfast bundle. Savor a small hot or iced coffee, then add your choice of a mouth-watering hot breakfast sandwich and a crispy golden hash brown and your pick of a classic donut.
Yeah,
all for $6, all just for you. Make your mornings all about me time with our $6 breakfast bundle. Available at your neighborhood Tim Hortons. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Monday, August 12th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the biggest news from this year's D23 Expo. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
All right, Jacob, you just got back from a whirlwind trip to Anaheim, California. You were there in person covering the D23 Expo. There's a big Friday night panel presentation from Disney showing off all sorts of stuff. I've linked to all of the footage recaps and reactions and news articles and stuff like that that we have published at Slash Film in the show notes for this episode. So if anybody wants to like do a true deep dive into all of the details, we don't have time to get into all of that today, but I want to make that as easy as possible for people to track down. So before we get into some of the favorite things that you saw, Jacob, and most interesting things that you saw, what was it like being there? This is your first big work trip in a little while and first time at D23 in a bit. So what was the vibe like?
Yeah, I haven't been to Anaheim since 1991 when I was 3 years old. I've talked before in this podcast about being a big Disney guy and big theme park guy, but I was always a Disney World kid growing up. You know, every 4 to 5 years, my family would take a trip to Florida. So it was really, really cool to get to Anaheim. And, you know, Friday was a work day. You know, spent all that day, you know, making sure stuff on slashfilm.com was taken care of and telling the panel and working with the team to coverage up. Then Saturday, I stayed a bit longer on my own dime. You know, went to Disneyland for the first time since, you know, 3 years old. And just, wow, what a great time, what a great park. I know people always say that Disneyland hits differently than Disney World, and it really does. I had such a good time. I don't know how much you or anybody else listening to this wants to hear about my Disneyland trip, but I will say that if you are planning a Disneyland trip during the day, during D23, when people are attending the convention, crowds at Disneyland were really low. It's only during the evening that I started picking up and people started leaving the convention. Mm. So keep that in mind if you're ever planning a trip.
Okay, so yeah, what I actually would love to do is talk about some D23 stuff, and then in the back half of the show, I'll just like open the floor to you to give me all of your Disneyland reactions, because like you said, it's the first time that you've been to that park. So or did you go when you were a really little kid? Or
I was 3 years old, so it was before California Adventure, before Star Wars was there. Even before like the Indiana Jones ride was here, that was 95.
Wow.
So I have these important, you know, Inside Out-esque core memories of Disneyland when I was that young. So it was special to go back and try to, you know, realign those memories with my adult mm-hmm.
self. Awesome. Okay. So let's get into some of the biggest news that came out of D23. Personally, Jacob, I was interested in Andor season 2, the title for Avatar 3, which was revealed as Avatar Fire and Ash, and some of the details that came out about Toy Story 5, which is obviously a new Pixar movie that's coming out, I think 2026. But there was so much news, just a true onslaught of stuff. And
I felt bad for you, Ben, because the schedule said 2 hours. So all the East Coasters who agreed to help out were like, yeah, we'll be out of here by 11 p.m. And that thing ran over 3 hours. It was outrageous. I mean, that was a big topic of conversation amongst the press in the transport afterward, heading back to the hotel, was how everybody back home was like, it wasn't just you guys. It was other teams, other websites were all like, it's 1 a.m. Can we go home now? Like, no, it's still happening. Detroit Mufasa footage now.
Okay, so I think the best way to approach this, Jacob, is maybe you can give me like the sense of what it was like in the room, and then you can just run through, yeah, maybe the top five things that you saw.
Yeah, I mean, do what you want about Disney, but they put on a really good show. They this year the massive panels, the ones that they want, where they're having all the exclusive footage. Like for Friday night, it was, you know, all the movies and TV stuff, and for Saturday night, that's where they held their big theme park news panel. They did it at the Honda Center, which is the hockey rink in Anaheim, and they didn't fill every seat in the arena, but it looked like they came pretty close. It was a jam packed in a way that makes a Comic-Con Hall H look kind of small in comparison. I mean, if Disney's plan was shock and awe, they did A+. It was a really well done presentation, technically flawless, sound and projection was incredible. The only weird thing about the entire event was that they would like bring out like massive casts for lots of these shows, movies they were hyping up. Like they would bring up the entire cast of Mufasa, for example, for the grand finale. But they wouldn't say anything. Like here's Seth Rogen and Billy Eichner and so 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 and so, and they're all out there. And they say, now here's some footage, or you know, for other things, like they'll bring out, you know, various cast members and like this, and they'll be on stage for 5 seconds and say, here's footage. And I'm glad they didn't speak most of the time, because it would have made a 3-hour long show even longer. Mm-hmm. But it definitely was interesting, because it makes you wonder, like, why is Jude Law allowed to monologue about his love of Star Wars for 3 minutes before the trailer for Skeleton Key shows? But other actors who clearly had to be flown out first class and put up in a hotel because their talent are just brought up to stand on stage and wave. I would love to talk to the people organizing this and figure out the logistics of, was it really worth bringing, oh goodness, Ben, I'm blanking on the lead actor from Avatar.
Oh, Sam Worthington.
Thank you. Like they brought James Cameron. Like I was not expecting to see James Cameron in at D23. It was very exciting to see James Cameron in person, for him to talk about Avatar 3 for a little bit. They brought Sam Worthington and Zoe Saldana as well. And Zoe Saldana was lovely and did like a few seconds of like, you know, hi, I'm so happy to be here. And Sam Worthington literally said nothing. I think he said like something along the lines of, like, I don't have anything to say, but in a joking way. And Cameron made a wisecrack about how this is why we pay people to write lines for him. But I'm like, I'm just wondering, you had to fly Sam Worthington out here, or assuming he was, you know, in, you know, shooting overseas for Avatar, zip in Los Angeles, where it could have, by the way, you're booking a nice car, you're arranging a plane ticket, and you're putting up in a hotel, presumably. Like, what is who has to say yes or no in the Disney accounting department to make this sort of walk on okay? So anyway, yeah, that's my rambling about this event, because it really was a really well done show. With some really baffling little moments like that, where I'm wondering, was that worth it? Was that worth that money? Anyway, all that said, can I briefly talk about the things I did not like?
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely.
So, Disney Umbrella is huge. Like they have so much stuff now that, like, I don't know how you define a Disney fan. Like, are you here for the Marvel? Are you here for the Star Wars? Are you here for the animation? Are you here for some combination of all of the above? And the answer is, like, watching this, I'm like, okay, I'm still here for the Marvel. I'm shaking on Marvel these days, but I'm still here for it. I'm still here for the Star Wars. I'm still here for the Pixar. But it's very, very clear that I'm not here for the live-action remake stuff. And that's kind of how the evening ended. It's the third hour getting deeper. We start realizing, oh, they haven't talked about the live-action Disney remakes, and that's going to be how they're going to end this. And they did. And Ben, I don't think anybody in the world decided for Mufasa. Like, it's going to make $1 billion by default, but I can't. Nothing they showed here. The trailer was underwhelming. You can watch the trailer online, but they also showed a full song sequence with a new song by Lin-Manuel Miranda. And I'm normally a big Miranda guy. I genuinely love him and love his work. I know it's not cool to like him anymore, but I still do. But the song was really underwhelming, and it's being sung by those photorealistic animated lions, so there's no real choreography to it. Mm-hmm. It's just them kind of wandering through a photorealistic plane singing at each other. And I don't know, I love Barry Jenkins. I'm glad he's getting a massive Disney paycheck for this. The guy deserves it. He deserves to have all the money he needs to go make another Underground Railroad, another Moonlight, another If Beale Street Could Talk. But man, I'm just not feeling Mufasa at all. I just don't get the appeal. And I think ending an otherwise really well done and like really lavish 3-hour presentation on Mufasa kind of let the air out of the room in a weird way. Probably the one misstep in terms of presentation from 3 hours.
Yeah, I'm guessing they had to end with Mufasa and Snow White because Mufasa's coming out this year. It's coming out in December, and then Snow White's coming out in March of next year. So like these are, I don't think anything else on that scale is coming out sooner. You know, like there's some TV stuff that's coming out sooner than that. But for the most part, like these are, I think they were trying to end on a note of excitement to get people psyched about these projects that are coming up like very, very soon. And it sounds like they mostly kind of fell flat a little bit. But yeah, certainly for us, like it's just, it's so unnerving maybe to see a filmmaker of Barry Jenkins' quality and stature be sucked into this Disney machine where even the end product, I mean, I don't know, we haven't seen the final movie yet, but just like everything I've seen from the movie, including the new footage that they unveiled to the public, is just like really visually horrific to look at. Like, and it's the same problem as the Jon Favreau Lion King movie, where it's just, it removes all of the life from the animated stuff and just turns it into, yeah, this photorealistic blah, you know. It's just it's very disheartening to see somebody who I respect and admire as much as Barry Jenkins be pulled into that. But
yeah. Well, I'll say as much, if you want to think it's horrifying but not blah, Snow White, I know that the trailer is online now, but they showed a full musical number from the final movie at D23, and it's the Whistle While You Work musical number, and Rachel Zegler is, I think she's great. I love her. She's an amazing voice. She's an incredible actor. I love that she's a no bullshit person in real life, and I am excited for her future as an actor going forward. I'm glad that she's collecting a Disney paycheck for Snow White, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But I can't get over the visual look of this movie. And I know that when they first announced this film, little person actors were up very outraged about the idea of this movie being made, about perpetuating stereotypes. And rather than probably say, maybe we shouldn't make Snow White, maybe, or considering maybe we should pivot in a way that changed it entirely, the seven dwarf characters are now all CGI. And you probably have seen glimpses of this in the trailer they released online, but I was able to get a long, hard look at these characters in the full scene. And Ben, you know those fan works you see online where it's like, what if Homer Simpson was real? And like it's like this grotesque realization of this exaggerated cartoon character with all the pores and sweat and hairs all realized, and you realize that what's cute and funny, you know, in 2D hand-drawn character animation becomes like singularly horrifying when you make it literal.
Mm-hmm.
All the dwarfs look like, man, they all look like that. They all look like disgusting horror fan art of the original, you know, Walt Disney's Snow White dwarf designs. And those designs are classics. They're funny and they're adorable, and they like define those characters like in a moment, because you know that's what a good caricature artist does, is that, you know, with a series of 2D lines you stamp a personality. So the moment you take those exaggerated designs and put them in 3D, it becomes like stomach churning. And I said this on our work Slack today, but I oftentimes think when people say like, you know, oh, that movie looks so horrifying, made me sick to my stomach, it's usually performative. People are kind of exaggerating for comedy's sake. But like watching the dwarf characters as they're animated and visualized in this footage literally turned my stomach. I can't imagine watching the whole movie. I can't.
Yeah, I promise you and the world and anyone that unless there's like some sort of work-related emergency reason why I and I alone have to see this movie, I will never watch Snow White. Like I'm so tapped out on these live action movies, but this one in particular just looks like an absolute nightmare. So yeah, that's not happening. Okay. Well, one last thing before we move off on this, I just noticed that Aaron Cressida Wilson, who is a screenwriter who worked on Secretary and movies like Chloe and Girl on the Train, is one of the people who co-wrote the screenplay for Snow White alongside Greta Gerwig, who I totally forgot was involved with this. So same thing in terms of the Barry Jenkins feelings that I mentioned a moment ago apply to Greta Gerwig. Like, good for her for getting the money, but like, God, that's so it's so sad to me. But anyway, okay, let's get into some positive stuff, Jacob. There was, you know, despite the tone that we've expressed here on the podcast so far, there was actually some stuff that you liked that you saw.
This was largely a good panel. And the thing is, with the exception of the Snow White stuff, like for example, Percy Jackson season 2, it's not for me. The Descendants Rise of Red, not for me. Disney Umbrella is huge. The people in that room who are excited for those things, you can hear them cheer. I'm like, good for them. I'm glad to hear for them. But that's not for me. So that's my whole thing is like, there were very few things where I watched and said, ugh, that is horrible. Like, it was a combination. There was like only a handful of things where I was like, ugh. There was a lot of stuff where I was like, okay, there are fans of this. I'm happy they're here to see it. So I felt no ill will toward it. But even then, like, I'm watching going, yeah, I'm not super excited for Freaky Year Friday, but you know what? There clearly are people in this room who are pumped for it. And, you know, that's okay. So, so we'll skip the stuff that, you know, that wasn't for me. Focus on the stuff that, you know, left me either pleasantly surprised or stuff that clearly was for me.
Okay, so hit me up with your first thing you want to talk about.
Avatar 3, aka Avatar Fire and Ash. They showed some concept art. People photographed the hell out of it, even though they weren't supposed to. So you can find it all online. James Cameron is on that stage. Man, just anytime you get to hear James Cameron speak, that guy, I know he's, the most arrogant son of a bitch alive, but man, I love his movies. I even love the freaking Avatar movies at this point. Like, Avatar 2 is just chef's kiss. I mean, Avatar 1, it's okay. Avatar 2 and literally everything else he's made, yeah, bring it on. And they showed concept art for the new Na'vi, these Na'vi who live in the fiery volcano mountains of Pandora, and they look very creepy. They have like covered in white ash and wearing like these strange masks and just a very menacing look to them. And after the big turn toward, you know, aquatic creatures in the second movie, there's a lot of more airbound stuff in the concept art here again. A lot of characters are riding the banshees and these giant airships. They kind of look like organic airships. I couldn't quite tell like where the construction begins and what part of them are maybe partially animals. But if you like can imagine like a fantasy airship, like something of a steampunk story or a Final Fantasy video game with sort of like a jellyfish like sail holding them up. Now, it looks like we're going to see some pretty big aerial battles around volcanoes in part 3.
And is it kind of like is it kind of like a less or mechanical version of the creature / ship thing from the end of the first Avengers movie during the Battle of New York that's kind of like flying where all the like Chitauri warriors are coming out of it? You know what I mean?
No, I wouldn't go that far. It definitely looks like more of a sailing ship in the air than anything. Okay. But my whole thing is, after Avatar 1, I was absolutely part of the wave of people who was like, Avatar was popular, but it has no cultural standing. And then Avatar 2 came around, and I kind of got bitten pretty hard by Avatar. And I love James Cameron. I say let him run wild. And I love that they flew James Cameron all the way to D23 to show concept art. Utterly ridiculous. If you're going to bring somebody out on the stage like that, you should let them talk at length. And Cameron got a good 5 minutes talking about Avatar 3. And yeah, so Avatar 3... I wish you'll still call the Seed Bearer, because that's a ridiculous title, the rumored title for many years. But Fire and Ash is pretty good. And at this point, I'm all in on whatever Jimmy C wants to do for us. So, Avatar. I'm excited.
Okay, what else?
I'm going to lump the Pixar stuff together, because I thought that the Pixar section of the presentation was largely successful. They brought out Pete Docter, you know, who's now running the show at Pixar. And I think a few years ago on this show, around the time Soul came out, and that was his last directorial debut before he... after his last total effort before he, you know, took up the reins of running the whole studio, I said that, you know, Monsters, Inc., Up, The First Inside Out, and Soul, that's the kind of track record that if we had applied to any live action director would, put me in the conversation for one of the greatest living filmmakers of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel very strong about Pete Docter as a creative force. And the fact that he's running Pixar now is very exciting to me. So it was fun to hear him go out there and talk, and he talked about some of the usual stuff that we're expecting. They announced Incredibles 3, you know, to be in development. But I wanted to dwell on the footage they showed from Elio, which we didn't end up writing up because I had a hard time being able to translate it, because it was a very, very fast footage, and I think it's probably going to be a trailer that's going to be released soon. Also because it was hard to relay what was happening when there's like no reference point for the folks back home to try to write this up for us. But, Elio looks really, really fun and really, really cute. And I'm glad they spent a lot of time at this presentation hyping up the Pixar originals. I mean, they announced Toy Story 5 as well, which is going to be about, you know, what do the toys do when they're being replaced by iPads and tablets and video games, which is an interesting concept. But they really didn't have much to do other than, you know, bring Andrew Stanton out. He was going to write and direct and, you know, show a piece of concept art. whereas he's been a good large chunk in Elio. And Elio looks like a hard sci-fi movie in the vein of Contact or Interstellar, but like made with families in mind. It's about a kid on Earth who is obsessed with aliens and gets abducted, or rather taken by aliens, and introduced to the giant federation of alien races who are essentially exploring the galaxy, and becomes default essentially Earth's ambassador to the galaxy. And it looks really, really funny and sweet and cute, but also seems to have a real underlying sci-fi edge to it. That's kind of what took me from the footage, was that it legitimately looks like, oh, what if Contact was, you know, an animated, you know, kid-friendly movie, as opposed to a more heady thing. I'm glad that, you know, Pixar is really put their foot out there saying, yes, we're announcing these sequels. Toy Story 5 is happening. Incredibles 3 is happening. But here's Elio. And also they debuted a new movie called Hoppers, which has a very strange concept about scientists who can place people's minds into robotic copies of animals to go investigate the animal kingdom, essentially. And look, the brief footage they showed there, they 30 seconds to finish the animation, looked like Pixar doing Looney Tunes. It kind of had that kind of vibrant slapstick energy. I was like, okay, I'm on board with this. So I was really happy to see Pete Docter out there to give us a sequel news we knew was coming, but also to like spend more time on Pixar originals than on sequel stuff. So that was really heartening to have Pete Docter come out and be like, yes, we know you want Toy Story 5, but Elio and Hoppers are also coming too. And it's always the thing I always have to remind myself is Disney loves their franchise and their sequels. Yeah, because those things are, you know, going to make money. But, you know, Elio could be the first in their franchise. You know, maybe we'll be tired of Elio 3 in 10 years. But you don't get franchises unless you take risks on original things that people grow to love. So I love that Pixar is still out there doing their thing. I guess also I want to touch on Dream Productions, which is the Inside Out streaming series that they're making, which takes place between the first and second movies, and it's filmed or animated in a mock documentary style, like The Office, like Parks and Rec, with a handheld camera, and follows the crew of Riley's dreams as seen inside movies, where the film crew essentially makes her dreams. And the teaser trailer they showed was very funny, and like seems to be like very much a fake behind the scenes how we're making these movies / TV shows, except that they're, you know, making dreams. And as somebody who loves both Inside Out movies and was like, you know, very happy to return to that world, I watched this footage and yeah, I will absolutely watch this Pixar fake documentary series about making dreams. I don't know, Pixar's been in a slump the past few years, you know, financially at least, and I just felt proud of my guys at Pixar. I got my guys and ladies and whatever you want to say, because I feel like I have a personal stake in the company at this point. I put too much of my heart in Pixar to let like a couple of box office duds slow them down. So I felt really good about Pixar after this panel. And I think that Toy Story 5 and Incredibles 3 are the headlines, but it was the original stuff that made me feel really good about that company right now.
Excellent. Okay, let's take a break and then we'll be right back.
Your next great vacation might be something you've never even considered. A private yacht in a beautiful location just for you and your closest friends and family. Explore the beaches of the Virgin Islands, the ancient shores of Greece, or the tropical paradise of Tahiti. This is not a cruise. This is a yacht charter vacation with The Moorings. And it's easier than you think. With hundreds of award-winning yachts to choose from, located in over 20 beautiful sailing destinations, the world is in your hands. Whether you're an experienced boater or looking for a more genuine once-in-a-lifetime vacation, The Moorings can make your dream a reality. Call us today and start your journey to your next great escape. Your private yacht awaits at moorings.com.
All right, Jacob, what else from D23 really impressed you?
I just want to say that when they showed the Agatha All Along trailer, which hit the internet moments after it played at the convention. But I will say this is the case of the how Disney puts on a show, which is apparently Agatha All Along will have original songs in it, which is great. Bring on more songs. And one of the songs reminded me very much of, as if 80s PG horror had a soundtrack, I don't know, that doesn't make much sense to maybe anybody else except me, but they started playing a song, one of the songs from the soundtrack for Agatha All Along, and a bunch of robed witches emerged from the smoke, and you realize they're singing it live, and they take off their hoods, and it's the actual cast of the show. Like, all the actors like in character is their witch characters from Agatha All Along singing this creepy, you know, witchy song, and there's fog everywhere, and it was just one of those things where it's like, oh yeah, if you're going to have people here for a live show, make it a live show. So I like that trailer. It's the first Marvel TV thing in a while where I feel pretty like, where I feel like, yeah, I want to watch that. It looks different and interesting. I liked WandaVision, and I like the idea of this very Halloween vibed, you know, witch Marvel horror show. So I will say I like that trailer, but if Disney wanted me to be more interested by having everybody on stage surrounded by, you know, fog machines singing in red robes, then yes, mission accomplished, Disney. I will watch Agatha All Along based on that song performance.
It's all part of their long game just to get you and you alone interested in this. Okay, what else?
I want to talk about the Star Wars block, because this is another case where you and I have discussed Mandalorian before on this show, Ben. Neither you or I are big Mandalorian fans, and I'm at peace with that, really. My whole thing was, I watched it, and I know it's massively popular, and people love Mandalorian and love Grogu, but I'm not up there on that show. I've watched a little bit of seasons 2 and 3 for work, but never finished all of it. And my initial reaction was, this Star Wars is not for me. My young niece, it's her first Star Wars, and she loves it. She loves Grogu, she loves Ahsoka, she loves all those newer characters. And I felt kind of at peace being like, okay, this is not my Star Wars, but I'm not mad at it. This is for other people. This is going to get other kids super interested in Star Wars, and it's for them. That said, Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni came on that stage with the first footage from The Mandalorian and Grogu, which just started filming a few weeks ago. So I had assumed.
And this is the movie, for those who haven't been tracking, you know, this is the movie that's coming out, I think, 2026.
Yeah, the live action adventures, the live action big screen adventures of Mandalorian and Grogu. And they started filming a few weeks ago, and I assume they said, oh, we brought a little treat for you guys, that they would have, like, you know, one scene with no visual effects. So they had essentially like a minute-long trailer full of all kinds of very finished-looking effects and very big action, very strong spaghetti western vibes, and characters from Star Wars Rebels who I recognized from like toy packages but don't actually know their names. I apologize. Popping up live action. You can audience cheered at that. And a very impressive visual effects shot of Mando and Grogu driving a two-legged like walker down a steep mountainside into battle against two AT walkers. I watch this footage and I go, maybe Mandalorian is for me? I don't know. I don't know. All I know is that I was super impressed and taken aback by how finished this footage was and how clearly Filoni and Favreau came to play. Like they came to be like, we're not going to show up and disappoint you. They really showed up and said, like, we have a crowd of 1,000 people here. We're going to bring the goods. So even though If I was this impressed by this footage and this like pleasantly surprised by it, then I can't imagine how excited like people who, for them, this is their Star Wars, you know, were reacting to it. So
right.
All power to those folks, all power to, you know, the people who are big fans of those characters. But I will say, my Star Wars is Andor, and they didn't have any finished footage, but they had a sizzle reel. They had like a lot of behind the scenes footage, a lot of filming of stuff. The finished scenes we did see were the things I love about Andor, which is people standing in dark rooms looking concerned. Lots and lots of shots of Cassian Andor and Stellan Skarsgård and Mon Mothma just looking like the weight of the world was on their shoulders. And that's my Star Wars, baby. People stressed out in dark rooms.
Amazing. I'm trying to think of, was there any other? Oh, the Skeleton Crew. You mentioned that. They Disney debuted the trailer for the Skeleton Crew, which is like essentially like an Amblin Goonies-esque type of show in space. And Jude Law plays a Jedi in that. So people can go and watch that trailer themselves at the link in the show.
For that trailer. I had no expectations for that show, but the sheer number of practical monsters and creatures in that trailer like really won me over. And look, if you're going to say we're doing Amblin in Star Wars, like it's literally a trailer literally has kids on hover bikes in space suburbia going on an adventure. And I said, okay, a lot of people say they're going to do Amblin. But I admire any show that takes it that far. So this one has my attention. I was not prepared to be interested in Skeleton Crew, but that trailer won me over. Did it do anything for you, Ben?
Not really, no, unfortunately, because I feel like I've just been burned too many times, like especially with The Acolyte. Like I was so invested after those first two episodes and like the whole promise of that show being like, oh, it's this thing where it doesn't really tie to anything else. And it's, you know, what I had been clamoring for years from Star Wars, like give me something new, disconnected. And the third or fourth episode of Acolyte was so tedious that I just couldn't finish the show. And I just like, it completely zapped any interest I have in the Star Wars franchise outside of Andor, basically. And until something else comes along that that proves itself over a long period of time to be of high quality, then I think I'm just like gonna disengage from Star Wars as a whole, because I can't do it anymore. but I understand that that people, you know, you've got John Watts, you've got like the Daniels directed some episodes of this show, who did Everything Everywhere All at Once. You've got like a lot of high quality people behind the camera, but I feel like the same could be said for Acolyte, and that just didn't really pan out for me personally. So there's a lot of potential promise there for folks who are willing to engage more with Star Wars than I am these days.
Yeah, I would love to love Star Wars again. For me, my whole thing is, I think the Star Wars fandom is experiencing the culture shock that I think Star Trek fans are used to, which is that Star Trek fans are used to there being so much Star Trek and a large percentage of Star Trek being bad Star Trek. That's just how it always has been for Star Trek. You love the stuff that's good and you deal with stuff that's bad. And Star Wars used to be so much smaller, you know, a movie every couple of years, if that. And I think that Star Wars fandom is having the growing pains of not being used to there being lots of bad Star Wars. So I do think that in 20 years, Star Wars fandom will be very much settled into the same groove as Star Trek, which is, oh yeah, I love this one, that one sucks, and kind of be on level about it. Whereas I think that's part of the big reason why things have been so loud these past few years is that Star Wars fans haven't learned to chill out like Star Trek fans have.
Yeah, the growing pains for sure. Okay, so what else did you want to talk about here before we get into your Disneyland adventure?
Yeah, the last thing, the most pleasant surprise of the night, the thing I was still thinking of and kept on writing about, like with the crew, the footage from Tron Ares. I just want to say I don't like the original Tron. It's, you know, really beautiful and interesting to look at. I love the aesthetic. I love how it looks. I love how it sounds. But the movie's really boring. And there's Tron Legacy, which, you know, I love you. Once again, I love the aesthetic. It's beautiful to look at. That Daft Punk soundtrack is incredible. Put it on just a soundtrack and like put it on the biggest, loudest screen possible. And oh man, that movie's fun to look at. But that story is nonsense and it's really boring if you actually engage it. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a Tron guy. As much as I love how it looks and sounds, I am straight up not a Tron fan. But they said that they have Tron Ares footage. And I was like, okay, yeah, well, more Tron. And Ben, the Tron Ares footage really won me over. I am really excited for what Tron Ares appears to be.
Can you give a brief recap of the footage that you saw?
The footage was very much... They talked about the plot first before they played the footage. The plot of the movie is that Ares, the main character played by, or I guess the main antagonist played by Jared Leto, who I don't like, by the way, so I'm even more mad that I like this footage because Jared Leto is the focus of it, is that he's a warlord from the Tron universe, the program world, who manages to come into our world and decides to essentially invade our world and take it over and make it up over in his own image. So it's about the bad guys from Tron essentially invading Earth. And the footage, they said, was unfinished, and because the movie, you know, only recently wrapped filming, but it looked really good. It's something they cherry-picked good shots, and the footage was lots of imagery of Tron, you know, iconography slipping into our world, but it all had this real menace to it. There was a real horror vibe to it. The closest thing I can compare to it, I don't want to make this comparison because, you know, it's going to sound, it's a really highfalutin one, but the visual aesthetic seems to be shooting for something akin to Blade Runner in terms of this sort of nightmarish dystopian view of like our reality colliding with the, you know, program reality from Tron. Mm-hmm. So things like, you know, the light cycles and those giant, you know, V or U shaped space vehicles. I don't know, Brad told me what they were called, but I already forgot because I'm not a Tron guy. Sorry.
Yeah.
And like just the imagery of them, like, entering our world, what was not shot with like awe and wonder, but shot with like terror and horror, and everything was glowing lots of red light, and like images of like, you know, Jared Leto on a light cycle going down a modern day bridge, being pursued by police, and the light cycle leaving a trail, it's cutting cars in half as he drives through them. Images of like people on like hover bikes riding over open water while like giant Tron cities like appear around them, surrounded by these glowing red clouds. And as it was at this point where the music underlying all this footage, just really unnerving footage, started getting louder and louder and more atonal. Like every seat in the arena was shaking and literally rattling. Like I could feel my teeth shaking in the back of my head from this. I was already thinking, man, this music is intense. And that's when they revealed that Nine Inch Nails, you know, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, are stepping in for Daft Punk to do the soundtrack of this time. And whereas Daft Punk, you know, delivered a very poppy, sci-fi, you know, techno-driven score, the Nine Inch Nails score really confirmed, I think this footage, confirmed what I think the footage is trying to sell, that this is going to be kind of a scary movie, an unnerving movie. And they could have just cut this footage this way. I can't guarantee the film will actually feel this way. But the fact that there's a Nine Inch Nails score, and the fact that the main titular character here is the villain, and that there's so much red and darkness in the footage, made me think that Tron: Ares is going to be a sci-fi horror movie in a way that, you know, Tron hasn't been before. And as a horror guy, I was immediately interested. And I'm not necessarily a huge Nine Inch Nails fan. I think they're really impressive. Especially, you know, Trent Reznor is, you know, one of the great musical minds of the modern era of music. But like, it's just a combination of elements where I'm like, okay, this is immediately interesting. I went from having zero interest in Tron: Ares to wondering, okay, what the hell is this? And will the final movie feel the way this presentation felt? And if the answer is yes, then I am immediately interested in what happens next. But if this is a bait and switch and it's going to be just more of the same, then I'm probably out. But if this is like a truthful presentation of the tone they're going for, then Tron: Ares, I think, should be on every like sci-fi and horror fan's radar.
I mean, that's a pretty strong pitch, Jacob. And the cast for this is great. Like, Evan Peters is in this, Greta Lee from Past Lives, Jodie Turner-Smith, Gillian Anderson.
And in the footage, there's a moment where Ares, Jared Leto character, has like appeared in our world, and there's a reaction shot where it's like she's something online. It's like, who are you? And it's not like an awe and wonder shot. It is a sheer terror shot of her like realizing this guy is here to mess things up. Man.
So wait, which one appears to be the main character?
Greta Lee.
Okay, cool, yeah. Cool.
Evan Peters is also a villain, but he appears to be the human villain who the code he writes allows Ares to invade our world from the look of things. The footage opened with him doing sort of a TED talk about, you know, why look for an intelligence, you know, out in space. We look for intelligence in here, referring to the computer world.
Hmm.
Apparently he's going to be the mad scientist who ruins it all for everybody. Also, Jeff Bridges on the stage to introduce the footage, and Jeff Bridges either stoned or just very happy. I love that guy. And he's in the footage looking like, you know, sci-fi Gandalf, wearing white robes, bright white beard. I love that Jeff Bridges is once again getting trotted out for Tron. Just getting a chance to play sci-fi wizard, which seems to be... I think Jeff Bridges has been working his entire life toward playing a sci-fi wizard, Ben. And I'm glad he's doing it.
I mean, this is truly like one of the most... unlikely film franchises of all time for a person like Jeff Bridges, who just like appeared in this what potentially was supposed to just be like this one-off, you know, sort of like tech experiment in 1982, and then got resurrected whatever 20 plus 30 years later, and then another 15 years after that he's coming back for another movie. It's just really wild to think about it in those terms. So Tron: Ares comes out in theaters in October of next year, so stay tuned for that.
Not October, it makes more sense because the movie looks, once again, I really hope the horror angle is not a bait and switch, Ben, because that was what I took away from this, was that this does not look like a good time of the movies. It looks like a feel-bad time, and I'm really surprised they sold it that way. But also, why do you have Nine Inch Nails doing music for your sci-fi movie unless you want to have a bad time atmosphere? So I'm really intrigued.
Okay, excellent. All right, well, yeah, I did want to sort of open the floor to you and just have you tell me a little bit about your Disneyland trip. So, I mean, first time since you were 3 years old, like, what was the experience like? Because you were rolling solo there. I know you mentioned you had the opportunity to talk to our old pal Peter Cerretta before attending Disneyland and sort of trying to pump him for tips and stuff like that, because he's obviously like a big theme park guy. And check out Ordinary Adventures, his YouTube channel, if you haven't done that already. What was it like being completely by yourself and wandering around the happiest place on earth, Jacob?
Yeah, first of all, a few shout outs. Peter and I did not get a chance to actually meet up in person. We saw each other from across the arena. Literally, we waved each other across the arena, but following a 3-hour panel, we couldn't make a meetup happen. But Peter sent me like many text messages of advice like invaluable advice. And friend of the podcast, friend of the site, and former Slashem contributor, Nate Pester, who works at Disneyland, also proved invaluable in helping me set up my day. Nate, if you're listening to this, thank you so much. You really got me sorted and made the day so much easier to run through. So my first reaction to Disneyland is that it's so much smaller than Disney World. I'm used to Disney World, you know, as my go-to theme park, you know, growing up. Every few years my family went. So I'm not getting around Disneyland was so much more different because of how close everything is. But I think that Disneyland is more architecturally cared for. It's a more beautiful park. The aesthetics feel like they're more carefully maintained. And it just hit differently. It just felt smaller, more intimate. Everybody felt friendlier. And it could be a California versus Florida thing. I just don't know. But Ben, is California friendlier than Florida? You live both places.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's so hard to say because both of those locations are so like touristy that I understand where that argument is coming from because Orlando is like incredibly touristy and Anaheim is like a little bit more. There's a large population of locals that go to Disneyland all the time. And I'm sure the same is true for Disney World. Like my sister is a big Disney World person and goes all the time with her husband. But you probably get lost more in the shuffle there because it's so much bigger, like you said. So the fact that whatever the percentage of locals that is wandering around Disneyland at any given time is probably higher. This is just based on vibes alone. I don't have actual numbers to back this up. It's probably higher at Disneyland than it is at Disney World. Probably means that, yeah, like those the people that you run into there are going to be maybe friendlier and like not just the harried tourists who are pulling their hair out trying to maximize every single moment of their day, you know?
Yeah, well, I will say that Disneyland, I just had a great time. I don't want to like just ramble about Disneyland for too long because I feel like we've done that before, especially when Peter used to be on the show all the time. But I will say the things that were special to me is that the Indiana Jones ride, it's been there since 1995, you know, massively popular to this day still. But I've never been on it since it's a Disneyland only ride. It's not at World. And that may be my favorite theme park ride of all time, Ben. Have you ever been on that?
I have. I love it so much, especially the queue area, the line area. Like there's something about, you know, obviously Disney goes all out in terms of the theming and all of that stuff in any theme park attraction. But that one in particular, there's just something that makes me feel like a kid and it makes me feel like I could actually grab a whip and like, you know, climb up off of the what is probably like elaborate styrofoam or something and like, you know, jump and swing off using a whip or whatever. And just like, it feels like actual adventure is around every corner is the best way I can put it. But I love that ride.
Yeah, I rode that. Indiana Jones is one of the rides I rode multiple times. I rode Parts of the Caribbean a few times. I rode Big Thunder Mountain Railroad a few times. I rode Indiana Jones a few times because those are the ones that were really special and important to me. And I will say that there was a kid behind me in line at Indiana Jones Adventure and he must have been 8 years old. He's wearing an Indiana Jones hat. He's wearing a white button-up shirt. He's even wearing a satchel like Indiana Jones like would wear on an adventure in the movies. And he was like in character with Indiana Jones. He was taking every part of the line completely seriously, like in character, trying to navigate traps. And I just realized that I don't have kids, but the source of joy I got from listening to this kid enjoy himself was that, oh, Indiana Jones matters to this 8-year-old. It's not just us guys in our mid to late 30s and early 40s now who are like still interested in Indiana Jones. There are kids out there who are just as into the character as I was at his age. And that was so exciting because I was fully prepared for Indiana Jones to be the kind of thing that kind of aged gracefully into a classic that, you know, that people don't talk about anymore in the next 20 years just because of just the nature of Indiana Jones not being a massive franchise like Star Wars, you know, or you know, anything, or like, you know, Pixar stuff. I don't know. It warmed my ice cold heart, Ben, that there is an 8-year-old kid who loves Indiana Jones that much.
To cool your heart back down a little bit, Jacob, Dial of Destiny did not perform up to standards. So I think you're probably not too far off about Indiana Jones becoming, you know, this sort of waning franchise that holds a very different place in pop culture. But I'm glad that one 8-year-old kid is still sort of holding it down out there.
So. You see, I that's what makes me interested is that in just the same weekend, Disney announced that a new Indiana Jones ride coming to Disney World or in the next few years. So clearly, Indiana Jones movies aren't happening anymore. Indiana Jones iconography is still being embraced by Disney. So I think that those movies are going to be hopefully finding new audiences for years and years to come. And that makes me happy.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah, okay. I guess I'll also obligatory. Yes, I went to Star Wars Land, aka Star Wars Galaxy's Edge.
Oh, yeah. How was that?
It's as impressive as people say it is. I went twice. I went there first in the morning, then back at night. Nighttime is really incredible because they deliberately don't overlight it. It's very atmospheric. You know, all the language is in Aubrish. You know, it's a fake Star Wars language. So you kind of have to, you're encouraged to really explore. And like the attention to detail, like going up to a food service stand and asking for like, you know, a fountain Coke and looking over the counter and seeing that even the soda machine labels are all written in Aubrish. So like the Coke is, you know, doesn't say Coca-Cola or a familiar label. It's all written. You can recognize it as Coke. It's still the Coke logo, just in different language. But it's like one of those things where you realize, oh yeah, this really feels like I'm in an alien place and I could get lost in here. And you know, you can find YouTube videos and photos showcasing all that stuff. And it really is, it's a really impressive achievement. I wish I had more time to just luxuriate in that world because it really was fun. And it is fun to like, you know, you're wandering around and suddenly, you know, stormtroopers walk by, you know, with Kylo Ren, and they're looking for resistance fighters. And it's just a well-realized, well-done thing. They did a good job on it. People have talked about how good it is for a while now. And yes, I agree. It's all very, very good. And the marquee attraction, Rise of the Resistance. Indiana Jones is my favorite ride at Disneyland, but Rise of the Resistance is the most impressive thing there. It is the level of technology being used to bring that ride to life is pretty staggering. And it definitely sets a bar for what a theme park attraction can be and what it could do. Ben, I don't remember. Have you been to the Star Wars stuff at Disney?
I have not. No, I moved, I think, maybe a year or two after it opened. I just never had a chance to go. So I'm curious, but I don't know. I go to theme parks so infrequently that it may be a while before I get a chance to check it out.
Yeah. Well, you know, real quickly, not a Cars fan at all, but the Cars Land at Disney California Adventure Park is really impressive in that main ride, the Radiator Springs Racers. It's really good, really well done thing. And I ride it going, man, I'm not a Cars fan, but this is like a really, really well done ride. That's what I love about theme parks, Ben, is that it's like being able to appreciate the design and storytelling of a theme park ride is such a different thing than a movie. Mm-hmm. And 5 minutes spent with the Cars characters, it's like, yeah, that was fun and good. I can't spend 2 hours with them. I don't like those characters beyond 5 minutes, but it was just the right amount for me to appreciate the Cars world. Of course, the Marvel section in Disney California Adventure is a dud. Everybody's already talked about this, but it feels like a real missed opportunity. They did not lean into the world building of it at all. You put the Marvel's Avengers campus next to Cars Land or next to Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, and it feels like you're in a parking lot with some warehouses in it. That area needs some TLC, like major love. The Guardians of the Galaxy ride there is excellent. I didn't even go on the Spider-Man ride because everybody told me to skip it because it's not worth the trouble, which is a really disappointing thing to hear. I know they announced a brand new, like utterly massive Avengers ride coming there just this weekend. So hopefully that brings the area back up to snuff, but they really need to fix Avengers Campus because, oh boy, it is unfair to Marvel fans that, you know, 10 minutes away, they can walk through a Star Wars area built with such love and detail. Whereas Marvel, you know, one of the greatest universes, you know, full of characters and iconography out there, feels so slapdash. It needs help.
Yeah, so they announced that Robert Downey Jr. is coming back to play Iron Man in some of the rides that they announced too. So that seems to be Disney throwing more money at it and trying to at least announce and signal to the world that, hey, we know that this is probably not living up to what everybody expects, and we're going to try to put some resources into it to change that. So before we go, Jacob, one more question for you. I know you're a guy who, like, you know, you're very into all of the theme park stuff. You pay attention to the websites and you watch a lot of YouTube videos about theme parks and stuff. I was just curious if there was any particular aspect of Disneyland that you had seen in a YouTube video somewhere or something, or that you had read about that struck you differently being there in person than the way that you thought it might when you saw it on video.
At Disney World, once again, my home park, for lack of a better term, is the one I went to the most. If you were going to meet a character, I'm not necessarily a character guy. Like, I'm not one of the adults who stands in line and get pictures with characters. I think that's, you know, something I love that they're there. I love that, you know, they're especially for families and kids, you all meet those characters. But I've aged out of enjoying the process of meeting characters, because it always, at Disney World, always involved standing in a line, you know, in a queue for, you know, however long to get a picture with Mickey Mouse. And to me, that's time better spent, you know, finding a good meal or riding a great ride or whatnot. But Disneyland, even though it does have lines for certain characters, the thing I've always been told about, and I've seen videos, is that you'll be walking around and suddenly, oh, there's Mary Poppins. Oh, there's the Stormtrooper. Oh, there's the Genie from Aladdin. And they're just walking around, usually with a handler to make sure they're not accosted. But it made the park feel really alive and really like anything can happen at Disneyland, where at Disney World, everything feels so carefully planned and cordoned off. At Disneyland, I'm just like standing there checking my map, forget where to go next. And there's Mary Poppins and Bert, and they're walking by me. And because they're played by actual actors and they're just wandering around, interacting with people, they waved, and, you know, I waved back and smiled because, you know, what am I going to do? Not wave Mary Poppins when she waved at me? And it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, this is what makes Disneyland different, is that there's a degree of spontaneity here. It genuinely feels like, you know, magical in the way that anything can happen. Like somebody can pop up and just be near you and suddenly your day has changed. And like I said, I've seen that in videos. I was told that was a Disneyland difference, but it really did feel different and special. And like I said, I'm not a character guy. So I was so shocked by how much I was smiling as I noticed characters wandering around and like kids getting pictures with them and following them and, you know, little crowds forming as people wanted, you know, say hi to them. And like I said, that's not my idea of like a priority at Disney. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it was happening, it was making so many people happy around me, gave me a high I was not expecting. So that was probably my most unexpected thing.
Awesome. I did want to mention that there are several things that we didn't even talk about on this episode. So Daredevil Born Again had some footage. Ironheart had some footage, a bunch of Marvel stuff. So definitely check that out. There's some X-Men 97 Season 2 news that came out the day after Jacob left from D23. So all of that is linked in the show notes. If you want to learn more about any of this stuff, I encourage people to go there and click on those links. That'll do it for today's episode. You can find more about everything that we talked about at slashfilm.com. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you all tomorrow.
While the world whizzes by, enjoy a moment of me time with Tim Horton's $6 breakfast bundle. Savor a small hot or iced coffee, then add your choice of a mouth-watering hot breakfast sandwich and a crispy golden hash brown. Ooh. And your pick of a classic donut.
Yeah.
All for $6, all just for you. Make your mornings all about me time with our $6 breakfast bundle. Available at your neighborhood Tim Horton's. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.